Each year for the past 14 years, the IEEE has presented the IEEE Jack S. Kilby Signal Processing Medal. This important award, fondly referred to as the Kilby Medal, is what IEEE refers to as a major medal. It was founded by the IEEE Signal Processing Society, has been generously funded since its creation by the Texas Instruments Company. Jack Kilby loved being an engineer. He was an inspiration to many who decided to pursue electrical engineering as a career. While he is no longer in our midst, his influence continues. As I've already mentioned, because it's a major medal, the IEEE Jack Kilby Signal Processing Medal is presented by the IEEE within the IEEE Medals and Awards Ceremony that will be held this year in August in San Francisco, California. However, it has been the practice of the Medals Founding Society, that would be us, to present a special commemorative plaque from the Society to the Kilby Medal recipient. This year, the recipient of the 2011 IEEE Jack S. Kilby Signal Processing Medal is Ingrid Daubechet. Professor Daubechet is receiving this honor, quote, for pioneering contributions in the theory and applications of wavelets and filter banks. Ingrid could not be with us today, but she will receive the medal at the IEEE Medal Ceremony in August in San Francisco. But I do recommend we give her a round of applause in absentia. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's ceremony. I want to thank you all for attending and celebrating the IEEE Signal Processing Society's award recipients, the new IEEE Fellows, the recipient of the IEEE James Flanagan Speech Processing Medal, and the recipient of the IEEE Jack Kilby Medal. The Society holds this award ceremony annually at ICASP. I look forward to seeing you again next year. Thanks again.
Thank you, John, for presenting all these awards, and congratulations to the awardees. So this is closing the official opening and ceremony. And at the end, let me thank our musicians, Mr. Werner and Mr. Svejkovský, for making this a memorable event. Okay, thank you. We are on time. It's a miracle. And we are moving on to the technical program of our conference, the first plenary talk. I welcome on the podium our first plenary speaker, Henry Terry from Nokia, and Professor Visa Koivunen from Helsinki University of Technology, who will present our first speaker and chair this session.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have the great pleasure to introduce the plenary speaker of the day. Dr. Henry Terry is a senior vice president and head of Nokia Research Center. Nokia Research Center drives breakthroughs to enable new business opportunities for Nokia. Henry is responsible for 13 labs worldwide that pursue disruptive innovation and work closely with all Nokia operating units to promote open innovation and working on research projects in collaboration with leading global research universities and institutes. I believe that means that he spends a lot of time not only in his office but also at airports and aircrafts. Henry holds a PhD in computer science from the University of Helsinki, Finland, and he joined Nokia in 2004 as a research fellow in software and applications lab. His previous positions include working at AT&T Bell Labs and as a visiting research scientist at the NASA Ames, where he contributed to the Mars rover for the 2003 mission. He's the author and co-author of more than 175 academic papers on computer science, social sciences, statistics, and holds 5 patents. Some of his papers are very much in the scope of Signal Processing Society, including machine learning and he's been also a visiting professor at UC Berkeley and Stanford University. His other interests include longboard surfing and snowboarding, and I think that's why he likes to live in California nowadays. I've had the privilege to work in Henry's team on my sabbatical terms, and I've enjoyed every minute. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further delay, I'll give you Dr. Henry Terry.
Thank you. Good morning. Those of you who arrived from US, I know it's very early in the morning. I came from New York on Saturday to Finland, but I'm was mentioned, I've spent a lot of times on the plane, so I'm actually not sure which time zone I'm in. When I was thinking about what's the topic that I would like to touch today for such a, how would I say, wide scope audience, I chose data. And there are multiple reasons of choosing data. One was that I spent more than 25 years of my life for searching for the mythical data set that could prove that my methods are better than the others. Unfortunately, that search, of course, was a difficult one, not only because of the problems with my methods, but the access to data. And having worked long in the field and looking at multiple data sets, I know that where we usually end in that type of a situation is overfitting our methods to the particular data sets that we have available, or generating synthetic data sets, which we know that will have their own problems when you use them. So my field was a lot of what you would call machine learning or information theoretic learning or Bayesian learning. One of the reasons I was so fond of Bayesian learning, as we will hear later on during the conference, was that as I had so little data, the Bayesians were so much easier methods to apply than the frequentist methods. So I decided to talk about data today, just because I think it's a very common topic for most of the things that you see in the conference. But I'm taking a very different approach. I spend, again, a lot of time of doing theory, writing papers on the different types of mathematical properties of learning, and also implementing the different algorithms. And today, I'm going back to my roots of hacking. So I'm celebrating this year 40 years of hacking, which is a long time, and taking a little bit system perspective, as you will see. Now, so let's start. The title, Making Sense of a Zettabyte World, you might wonder what those green things are there that are going. It's not the worm game, the famous worm game that used to be in the old days and on the mobile phones. So if you look at those green things and you reveal something out of it, actually it is a description and representation of a mobile device that would be in a moving vehicle going around that white area. There is the Congress Center. So those would be the sensors that would be driving around the roads in the devices that you carry with you so dearly. Typically nowadays, which I call mobile computers because I'm a computer scientist, so everything is a computer to me. Now, this is synthetic data, as we say. But let's zoom a little bit. So this is real data. And this is real data as collected by the Nokia devices in Prague by looking at the navigation requests of the different devices in real time by, you know, superimposing them on this plane with the coordinates and the timing. As you can see, there is no map underneath, but after a while, you see this thing developing nicely to the map of Prague. So, if we go further and zoom out, this is a similar picture of Europe as seen by billions of queries of the OVI maps navigation. Notice, by the way, there are sort of interesting cultural differences. If we could start mining this, that's the topic of today. The green areas in France and also in Russia, so that those areas, the people are more interested in navigation as opposed to southern Europe, where the points of interest, meaning finding restaurants or others, are much more common. So there's a multitude of data that I've faced in my current life, It's also an era and a beauty of privilege to be in an era where this data fantasy or search of mine is starting to be fulfilled. We have access to data in a totally new ways due to the development of computers, due to the development of multiple different aspects that I'm going to touch today. So first, I want to discuss with you some of the sources of this type of data that is available to you. And my purpose is to challenge you later on to think about what do you need to do? What do you need to think about when you in real life want to address data sets like this and utilizing and sort of making sense of this data? So first of all, I showed you now data that was based on the GPS, location information in a time coordinates. Actually, any mobile device already collects multiple different sensor data at the same time. We know that they have accelerometers. Actually, for me, camera and audio is also a sensor. So each of these sensors that you add to these devices that are now so prevalent adds a new layer. And there are more and more sensors that are coming in the different radios that we are adding to these devices. There are more and more sensor data coming from the same sources, but added to this base layer of location and time. Why do I consider location and time to be different than the others? Because from my perspective, location and time conditions the usefulness of a lot of the data. So if you don't know your location, many of the applications, for example, like asking where's the closest beer pub, don't make very much sense. So location and time are very fundamental, but beyond that, you can add more and more layers, and you end up in these piles of data, which, of course, if you collapse them, shows how humongous amount of data we have available already from this type of a domain. Zettabyte. No, at least I get part of my language, but we are a room full of geeks, so we most of us are so excited about the different numbers. I was always puzzled when I studied mathematics that there are these different terms for the same numbers, and for in particular computer science, we are particularly excited of using those powers of two. So we talk about zettabytes. Now, zettabyte is an interesting number because it's a timely number. Currently, approximately this year, although much of the data is, in fact, copies of each other, we are producing 1.2 zettabytes of digital information. But this number also, as any large number, tends to be a bit difficult to grasp. So before sort of trying to look at the different sources of this, let's try to sort of reflect a little bit what it is. So, okay, it's approximately close enough to be sextillion, just 10 to the power of 21, so we have 21 zeros. But that doesn't tell us too much. So typically, if you want to just to get an idea of a big number, you should reflect it with some measure that you know. So let's say that one byte of this would be 1 meter. And a good question to you is that now, okay, if we have zettameters of a distance, how long would that distance be if we start from here? Is it here from to Moon? Here to Jupiter? Here to Alpha Centauri? Okay, so those who are very clever and fast with and know something about astronomy would figure out that this zeta meters is actually the same as the diameter of the Milky Way, approximately, which is about 100,000 light years. That's a lot, it's a big number. Now, I actually prefer some of the the bit more mundane references that you can find on the net when we were looking at the numbers. So one is that zettabyte is the amount of information if all the people on Earth would be tweeting 24/7 for 100 years. Or it would be like 75 billion 16 gigabytes iPads full of data, which actually fills 84 times the Mont Blanc tunnel. But my favorite is that if you like TV shows, it would be watching the you know the hit series, or actually the first episode of series of the TV series 24 for 125 million years continuously. Talk about getting bored a little bit, probably, some point in time. Okay, now the standard answer when we look at this type of large data set is that, hey, we should be using approximations, we should be using sampling, we should be doing, you know, not exact things, we should be somehow, you know, manipulating the data sets. And that is correct. It's actually a very old idea. In this era of tablets, this is a very old tablet, 8,000 years old tablet. It's a Babylonian tablet that in fact shows a approximation of the square root, a unit square, sorry, the diagonal of a unit square, then that allows us, in fact, to do square root calculations for construction and carpentry. So all sort of approximate measures, of course, are a very old thing. Now, unfortunately, approximate measures also, as we know, lose information. In certain cases, that is perfectly fine. Certain cases, it causes biases that we know will be very harmful. But the amount of data that we are talking about today by far requires us to go to this approximate method, of course. Oh, good heavens, I was pushing the wrong button. So let's look at a little bit about the sources of the data. Now, this is a different picture than the previous ones, because this is not showing the absolute capacity. It is showing the relative capacity of the type of the data that is available for you guys. So in the old days, when I remember when computer networks started, remember, 40 years of hacking, long time, there's a lot of FTP traffic going on. Email became very popular in the early 80s. There was something like Telnet. I don't know how many of you remember anything like that. But FTP was by far the dominating data that was available, meaning file transfer from one place to another. Let's move to 1990s. Early 1990s, we all know one of the still annoying facts to the computer scientists that the physicist sort of introduced the HTTP protocol and the web, but it was not a computer scientist invention. The web was born. And suddenly, as you can see, the FTP part starts diminishing proportionally. Remember, this is a proportional, not the absolute, you know, amounts are going up all the time. And the web is grabbing more and more share. News groups are pretty happy. Telnet is sort of disappearing. Email keeps it sort of a constant. In that. If you go further to 95, web has already captured half of the traffic. And you see in the upper corner something interesting, like data appearing from individual peer-to-peer communications of the computers, which didn't used to be the case in the past, because we only had these few mainframes going there. And if you go even further, to 2000, we can see that the video information starts to grab a larger and larger share of the digital traffic. Now, web is still strong, But video, the purple part, is just dawning there at the corner, peer-to-peer and web dominating, but it's growing very fast. So if you go now further, of course, to 2005, you see that the video is getting bigger. And I don't know whether it's because of the various different type of legal issues and other issues, the sort of percentage of peer-to-peer, anyway, it's not growing anymore the same way, and web is going down. And if you arrive to 2010, one could argue now that one of the most important and interesting data sources that we currently have is the video. And there's no sign of it going down at the moment. It's actually, if you believe Cisco, which of course can be a little bit biased view, the video will be so dominating in the next couple of years on the network traffic that it will be the majority of this. And the web is in fact going down proportionally, which is quite obvious because if you think about the bits required from the normal web accesses. So web, the type of data that is moving around in these networks is obviously video data. So a lot of the things that I used to be interested in, which were related with sort of pattern matching in text or some stuff in the files or music, is actually replaced now an interest to do this type of a mining or processing of video. So that was the web world. Now, talking about web, I just want to mention something because it touched me so much talking about the video, I want to touch something that really, really captured my heart in March in Long Beach, TED. This was Deb Roy's from MIT Media Lab work on capturing 90,000 hours of video of his child growing up, and mining that video in such a way that, for example, he could show in a speeded up manner of the development of the word water in the language development of the child. Again, a unique experiment, but related to today's topic, even more interestingly, his company, Bluefin, is working and delivering data sort of analytics or visualization of both of the TV broadcast related with the social networking traffic. Basically linking something that is shown on the TV on the discussions that you have on the net. Okay. A little bit different domain as a reference. So this is the Large Hadron Collider, for those of you who have not seen the great picture. I do remember that basically when the Large Hadron Collider and the data grid was planned, there was a lot of talk about the capacity issues. Now, first of all, Large Hadron Collider has 150 million sensors. So that's a lot of sensors, and we all know, of course, that these sensors are also producing then the data with the sort of very rapid speed. So the actual approximate sort of amount of data we're talking about in this tier structure is 1 petabyte per second. I do remember that the original specs when we started doing the data grid, I was there in this huge European Union consortia, which has its benefits and normal European Union consortia challenges, we were talking about 4.5 terabytes per second, so the volumes have gone up. Okay, 150 million sensors, cool. So this is the physics experiments, this is the science, big science, you know, what does it do with, you know, the regular world or whatever? This is a very special device, expensive device put somewhere. Let us come back. This is now a picture of the whole world related to the picture you saw already in, you know, Prague, Europe, the different queries on the navigation. This is based on 20 billion queries. Now, remember what I showed you earlier. There's about 1.2 billion Nokia devices currently on Earth, and of course, in the number of mobile devices is more than 4 billion now. If each of these 1.2 billion devices has 10 sensors, it's more than 10 billion sensors. These 10 billion sensors, although they don't feed the system with the same speed than a Large Hadron Collider would be, are still a super substantial amount of data that is available for us. And this is, I'm not talking about the future somewhere. I'm talking about the actual today. Not saying that all that sensor information is now anywhere collected in one place, but it really, really, really is showing the potential and the different paths that we have in the future. I mentioned the different types of sensors in these mobile computers, and I mentioned the sensors that are related with a lot of the user interface or various different types of positioning and so on. But there's an interesting new source that adds to this sensor pool, and that's the cognitive radio. I saw that there are some papers in the cognitive radio in this conference as usual. So just want to point out that from this type of a perspective, for those of you, by the way, the cognitive radio is then the dynamic allocation of the radio spectrum in such a way that the device itself can actually choose which part of the spectrum it's using for its signal transmission. Actually, it can be used for other things too, and for the sensor radio. So that particular introduction of cognitive radio will already bring us again, a new, very interesting source of sensor information, which is in the infrastructure itself. So the traditional picture of having the devices talking to a tower, cell tower, and we already know something about the signal strengths that they can hear, how the cell tower can recognize the device, is going to change to a picture which is a much more mesh, where the devices are aware of each other's presence or partially aware of each other's presence in different types of radio spectrums. Now, this fingerprinting information adds another layer, again, which is inherent to the billion mobile computer infrastructure that we have. Well, another source of data available for us, all intertwined, is the social media. There's currently about 900 million social media users in the world. Of course, if you look at that, that in principle means that there's about something like 1.5 billion visits to social networks every day. Each of these visits leaves a trace or is a operation. And of course, if you want to divide this, we know that majority of this is coming from a single source, Facebook, 700 million currently. But the important part here is that there's about 30 billion or more pieces of content accessed by these users. And this is the richest context we have on Earth for mining, because this is, as you know, in Facebook, all sort of information of all different types. It is both images, it is video, it is textual data, it is different links, it is sort of informative in a very different way. Additional things that you can, of course, see in the social space is that we have about 60 billion tweets expected in 2011. And this 60 billion tweets is still a growing number, because we have 460,000 new Twitter accounts added daily, which, by the way, is not the growth rate, because there are also people that dropped the Twitter accounts. But it still shows that the actual sort of population is growing. And of course, back to our favorite video. Notice that a lot of the traffic in the picture that I showed you earlier comes from YouTube, But, of course, in certain areas, like in United States and others, it comes also for Netflix and so on. So 13 million hours of video in YouTube. That doesn't look a very big number. Think about, I was talking about the billions in there. But please do remember that these videos are in 5-minute snippets or so. So actually 13 billion hours is much more in the number of videos that we have available. Oh, gee, I tend to push the wrong button. So 13 million hours of video uploaded to YouTube. 35 hours of new video uploaded per minute. So those of you working on video mining, you have a great future, you know, ahead of it. Now, I'm an optimistic and positive person, so I like this thing when all my life the things go up in the upper right corner. I like things growing, I like things becoming more challenging, I like things becoming faster, smaller, bigger, and so on. What's the problem? Well, the problem is that as opposed to, you know, having this thing on a paper as a formula or even as a calculation in your machine, we're talking about real systems here. And this data exists somewhere. We need to access it. We need to handle it. And if we want to make use of it, we need to build systems that sort of are able to work with it. What happens if you are not careful of building these systems? There's a crash. This actually the cover is from an older days, but 2010 we know that the 1,000 point decline in New York Stock Exchange in a very short period of time, which actually result of a complex cohorted computer softwares that were, of course, doing what they are supposed to do. They are competing on the market in a superhuman speeds with the available data that they have, making and looking at weak signals and sort of accelerating the crash. So like I always point out, it's nice to write a paper and have a good learning algorithm and a good predictive model. You better be much more certain when you start applying that in the real world and you cause some interventions in the real world. They're two very different things. So what I want to talk about, I was talking about the what now. What is the data available? I would like a little bit touch how. And why do I want to do it for this audience? I mean, I'm not talking in an operating system conference. I'm not talking in a networking conference. I'm not talking about the people even in my former field, which was database community. When I was a computer scientist undergraduate, I was taught about the memory computing trade-off. And a little bit later, I was taught about the paging and, you know, virtual memory and some of the aspects. My point is that we are now, unfortunately, in a different architecture. We are using a different system. And when we are writing our algorithms and when we are running them, we need to take into account to a nitty-gritty details which are beyond the Turing machine. They are even beyond the von Neumann sort of traditional computer model. We need to look at that aspect if we really want to work in the real life with these data sets. There's a big gap between what is the practitioner trade secrets in manipulating in so-called internet companies, for example, for the data, and the work we do and the very advanced work we do in sophisticated methods of understanding that data. Sometimes these things, the gap is smaller, sometimes it's much larger. So I want to talk about and leave you with a couple of the important aspects of the systems that we should take into account when we are writing our algorithms, when we are, you know, building them for zettabyte world, not building them for the, well, like my favorite was the Irvine data set that I overfitted so badly. Elasticity. One of the things that has changed dramatically is that when we are building things, we don't need to build them in such a way that we have to make sure that the maximum requirement is somehow constant. Because in the old days, when you had a computer, it had a certain amount of computing power, certain amount of memory, and it was a box somewhere. Now, elasticity is a notion, of course, that has sort of sneaked in with cloud. So elasticity allows you to use dynamically the computation power of a larger entity in such a way that you don't have to predetermine the amount of computing power that you're using. Now, this is akin to the same development that you had in the, I guess, the introductory data structure courses where one has fixed table sets and then dynamic tables. And you define a dynamic table and you don't have to care about that you will ever go out of that. So this feature where you need more data and you just grab more of the computing power, and then at the same time, of course, this is meaningful only because you have multiple users at the same time sharing this particular pool, you will go to a much lower need. So in some sense, this elasticity has allowed us to do things which were not at all feasible in the past. It was not that long ago, I think about 7-8 years ago, we were running multinomial PCA algorithms on a fixed cluster for search engine stuff, actually doing sort of search engine probabilistic modeling of the word occurrences in 100 million documents or more. And the typical run there was deeply limited by the computing power that we had, so we had to run like 3 weeks in a row in a small cluster to get a model of, let's say, 15 million or 20 million documents. Those who know PCA or multinomial PCA knows that it's sort of, unless you do something clever, it's actually quite computationally intensive thing. And there was no way of doing any kind of dynamic thing. So all our experiments were sort of restricted by the computing power at the university, which was not that great. So we had to work on that. By the way, the elasticity, for as a historical remark, it's an actually a very old notion. My favorite quotes from the science fiction literature, as many of the computer science ideas have appeared very early in the literature, is this first commercially sold story by Arthur C. Clarke from this astounding science fiction called Rescue Party. And Rescue Party was telling about a race called Palador, or in a place called Palador, with the race of Palador that had a collective mind. And depending on the problem in the universe, that race collected more minds dynamically to solve the problem. So by the end of the day, if you had a really, really big problem, this telepathic connection in the different places in the universe allowed to solve much harder problems. This was really, really early. So this was 50s. So I've sort of always amused how well some of the science fiction literature reflects of the future. The second aspect, as elasticity, you might think, okay, so this is the cloud stuff, is the robustness argument. The robustness argument is a very complex one because it's basically depending on what you want to do. So there's this nice result by Eric Brewer from Cal and others that depending on which dimensions you are interested in, meaning you're accessing some data and you want to do a consistent access, or you should be able to access when partitions are allowed in the network, or that data should be always available if needed, you can't satisfy all of these at the same time, optimally. You can only go in these different corners or different borders of the triangle in such a way that if you want to do, for example, search, you're actually very partition tolerant. You have certain type of consistency, but not all things are always available. Or if BitTorrent, where you don't care about consistency at all, you just basically are doing transfers, but you're very tolerant for petitions as those who want to legally impose against this type of piracy know, and things are very available. And on the other hand, in distributed databases that many years ago when I was working on them, the consistency and availability were very important, but they were not very tolerant for partitions. Now, why this is important? This is important because we are talking about highly distributed systems. Remember, I was talking about 1 billion devices that are just sitting in different parts of the world. They are connected by different networks. They are actually allowing different types of malfunctions and various things. There is no consistent, everything is up all the time notion at all. So when you're building your algorithms, they cannot be based on getting all the necessary information in place. By necessity, of course, I assume that you already figured out that in this zettabyte world, the algorithms have to be online nature. Batch algorithms of taking, you know, there's 20 billion queries and running them and doing it, it's usually not the way to go because the response times for the problems that you want to solve are not feasible. So we had elasticity and robustness. But the one thing that is so dear to my heart is energy. So I preach this every place I've been now for the last 2 years. So I'm preaching it here too. And I'm pointing out that if I were a grad student, I would go to this field of energy efficient computing. So my argument is that the current architecture, as we will see, is fundamentally imposing the similar, even theoretical, sort of boundaries to the computing as we used to do with memory and computing, energy. Why is this so? So let's look at the real life situation. Why do things become difficult? Let's take the example of a processing that you know, normally you're used to this type of processing where you have a single box. Now we are in a world where we have multiple devices that are connected to each other. And you have your algorithm, your great algorithm doing the video stuff, has a choice where to go, where to execute. So let's look about this, because this problem in particular, because it is a very important one. If you took look at the experience dimension, in the experience dimension, you can of course run everything in the device itself, which is this type of a mobile computer. You could do the video editing here. You get the video, you edit here, you get a display. Well, we know that in the case of larger things, this will be very, very, very slow. The user experience will be pretty bad. And in addition, there might be some other sort of user experience issues that we have. But it's basically local. Of course, we can do peer-to-peer, so we can steal somebody else's computing. Interesting idea, taking a little bit more computational power from the neighborhood to do the video editing. Fine. Or what we can, of course, do is that we think, okay, we have this elasticity up there. We have the cloud, so we send the video to the actual data up to the cloud to be processed there where you can fast process. Of course, there you add now time to transmit. So in the user experience dimension, one of the things that you want to usually, from a user perspective, to optimize is the time. It doesn't care. The user doesn't care where it happens. You just, as soon as it's immediate. We are living in a very immediate society. Well, this is the pure experience perspective. If you look at the economics perspective of this one, again, if you do everything in the device itself, notice that I'm now divided in such a way that the lower end is the device, upper end is the cloud, and in the middle there's a transmission layer. Somebody has to pay for the cloud. So by the end of the day, it usually doesn't come from nowhere. So you have to pay for that economics of the cloud. But from a user perspective, you're also paying on the transmission data costs in most places. So that will also be expensive. But then we come to the very fundamental question. If you do the video editing on the device, you're running out of energy in the current mode very fast. And we all know already that even taking pictures, not even editing on the video, will run out of our batteries very fast. So okay, not a very feasible thing. So what about if you just put it on the cloud? So I mean, then we don't run out. The next thing is we can steal our neighbor's energy. Doesn't make you very popular, because the person who wants to make a call next time and doesn't have any energy anymore probably doesn't like very much the idea that he or she has supported your video editing. If you go to the cloud side, we all know the problems already, that this is like a no free lunch situation. The cloud, the server farm, uses also energy. It might be, again, energy that is not immediately affecting you, but as a total trade-off, somebody will have a problem with the energy. And we're talking about green data centers nowadays a lot. There's also a fundamental limit, which is an interesting question, that how much can you concentrate in one place? Because you see, in the bottom approach, you're introducing new energy source every time you're introducing a new device that does the computing. In the cloud, the load, energy load, grows linearly at the end of the cloud side with respect to the customers it has to serve. But even more fundamentally, this trade-off, unfortunately in real life, tends to be controlled by the fact that sending bits takes much more energy than computing them. Partly this is because of the coding inefficiencies that we have. You know, we are so far from the Shannon limit that basically we are essentially have to put much more power than we would need to send the bit to correct the noise errors that we have. But basically, this balance is going to dictate almost all of the data manipulation I've been talking today. The balance between what you compute locally and use energy, where you have the energy up there, and then what's the transmission energy that you are doing. If you think about rendering, for example, large screens directly from the cloud. And I wanted to point out that academically, energy is a fundamental thing. Energy is something you cannot cheat. So it's very appealing theoretically. In real life systems, the economics and experience are the ones that really also dictate what will be used in practice. So my questions and my sort of problems that I want to leave with you is that basically we know and have shown that we have multiple sources of data available. The question is that how do we capture, parse, and analyze on them on the fly, meaning that I want to do things online from radically different sources? This is, the sensory fusion is one term that people use in different communities. We use different terminology. For me, it's just the heterogeneous attributes, the sources of that. The second question is the architecture question. What will it take to build these architectures that are truly robust and have strong elastic properties? How do you write your algorithm in such a way that even if you run it in a single machine, I would like to run it with 1 billion devices across the earth, maybe with the cloud component. The third question is that how do we tackle this energy efficient computing? Because in fact, like I said, from the theoretical perspective, almost like from the perspective that you have this abstract von Neumann model, you can look at energy as a different component there and do a lot of analysis. In real life, we need to balance environmental concerns, business practicalities, and the end user experience for this energy stuff. Now, why I say that energy is so fundamental, to me, it's fundamental for the reason that we first time in my lifetime, we are reaching the levels that I can argue that I can foresee services that cannot be built, not because of theoretical reasons, but because of the reasons that we do not have enough energy on Earth to run such a 6 billion user service, whether it's run on the devices and whether it's run on the back end. So this is what I wanted to leave you today. I just wanted to remind you that my search for the mythical data sets, that quest actually has been filled. I have all these different things in the world, excitingly there, lying there, and now I see that about 25 years of my life, I haven't solved very many things related with this data sets. I've solved a lot of things with related with other things, with you guys in the community, with the great PhD students that I have the privilege to work with. But basically, like I said, I now know that we are facing an era faster, almost sneaking to our existence, that we as research communities need to address in a different way. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say today, so thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Henry, for the very exciting presentation, and I believe we have a very challenging research problems to work on with the whole community here, and also problems that are of interest in terms of scientific effort as well as for the global energy consumption and problems that the whole Earth is facing. And we have time for a couple of short questions, so please, Stephen.
Oh, good. There's a mic, so excellent.
Thank you very much. Two issues that I did not see on your view graphs, but I think will be important in this environment are privacy and security. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I've solved it by creating my own cloud and access everything through there to address that. But how, you know, yes. if we're all networked together, how would that work?
Yes. I deliberately chose not to say the word privacy and security. Somebody characterized me a long time ago that, Henry, every research aspect you're always doing is violating severely people's privacy and that sort of. No, I take it very seriously. I just decided to leave it for a question because I knew that the question would come. Of course, first of all, absolutely, if I take a very scientist perspective, the more we gather information, the more I can reverse engineer it. That's a fundamental fact. And I can even do it in the ways that people think that you anonymize things or you add random noise, but if you can predict a noise model, you can reverse engineer a lot of stuff and you can do very complex things. Now, for me, first of all, privacy is always a trade-off. It's like reliability. There's a certain payoff you get from something and certain costs that you have. If the cost is higher than the payoff, you should not do it. So if the cost for your privacy and the aspect, you should be able to, first of all, you should always be able to opt out. That's the first thing. But the second thing that I want to point out that I learned and I never thought so much was that there are a lot of things where you can do a macro trend aggregate analysis without violating any kind of privacy aspect. You're basically aggregating like this traffic picture there, that was totally anonymous, no idea who is there, not even the individual points are followed in a sequence, they are just points in the time in the data set, and you don't know that they're coming from the same source. You can still do meaningful analysis. That's the first good news. Second good news for research community is that there are privacy-preserving mechanisms that you can build in this. They are sort of cryptographic ways of handling this thing, so it's a good research problem. The third question is that I usually do the challenge here. How many of you guys in this room has actually turned off your cookies? I mean, it used to be very popular. It used to be very popular. But also there's some benefit of not turning off them or laziness and everything. So it's very cultural occasionally what happens. But I'm totally with you. And my main point always is, users should know and users should be able to opt out. But if it's a choice that you want to get some benefit out of that information that is available. Security is a different issue. I think everybody shares the question of the security problems, the concern of the security problems that we have. And these are very complex issues. Again, cultural, even regulatory issues that we face in different ways in Europe, in US, and in Asia. My labs are working, and I'm working on growth economies to Western world, and I can tell you that these issues are very different in different markets. Security protocols are a good research topic too. I think the privacy concern tends to be the higher one among the people, and we know all the problems that currently are Facebook's and Google and others are facing in this particular domain. I decided not to overemphasize this because I was talking from a science perspective and as a research perspective, but we have to be, of course, ethically conscious about that work that we do too.
Right, another short question.
And hopefully a shorter answer.